From WHYY in Philadelphia, this is Fresh Air. I'm Barbara Bogave, sitting in for Terry Gross. On today's Fresh Air, The Simpsons. This Sunday, it airs its 200th episode. It's the longest-running network primetime animated TV series in history. On today's Fresh Air, where it all began. We'll hear from its creator, Matt Groening. Also, reducing the crime rate among teenagers. We'll hear from Boston probation officer Bill Stewart and Judge Sidney Hanlon on Operation Nightlight. It's part of a crime-fighting initiative in Boston, which has been highlighted by President Clinton as a national model. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Korva Coleman. Leaders of House Republicans have agreed to let campaign finance legislation come to the floor for a vote. Supporters of the bill had collected signatures on a petition intended to force the bill to the floor, even though House Republican leaders object to the legislation. Advocates of campaign finance want to ban soft money or big unregulated contributions to political parties from corporations, unions, and people. Individuals, Republicans, want to ensure that any bill curtails union political activity. An Alabama school system has settled a discrimination lawsuit over the harassment of Jewish students in the classroom. NPR's Debbie Elliott reports.
Wayne and Sue Willis sued Pike County, Alabama schools last year. They claimed their children, the only Jewish students in the school system, were teased, mocked, and preached to by Christians in the classroom. School officials in the southeast Alabama county have said that one of the Willis boys was forced to bow his head during a Christian prayer, and another was told to write a paper on Why Jesus Loves Me. The school board admitted no wrongdoing in settling the lawsuit, but did agree to a lengthy list of the do's and don'ts of schoolhouse religion. Attorneys for the family say the 13-page settlement is tailored to protect the Willis children from harassment. The settlement guidelines follow a federal judge's ruling that limits religious practices in Alabama public schools. The state is appealing that ruling. Debbie Elliott, NPR News.
Two cosmonauts from the Russian space station Mir took a space walk today. They replaced an engine that runs the station's solar panels, keeping the panels pointed toward the sun for power. The repair job lasted for more than 6 hours. Taiwanese negotiators have arrived in Beijing for bilateral talks with China, the first in nearly 3 years. Tomorrow's talks will pave the way for higher-level discussions in the future. NPR's Mary Kay Magstead reports from Beijing.
For China and Taiwan to even talk about talking is a considerable step forward. Just over 2 years ago, China was conducting aggressive war games in the Taiwan Straits and making threats about what it would do if Taiwan ever formally declared independence. Now, China's taking a gentler approach. Tomorrow's negotiations are aimed at setting terms for higher-level talks about eventual reunification. China considers Taiwan to be a renegade province. In reality, it's a sovereign entity. Taiwan's President Lee Teng-hui has said that Taiwan does not want to reunite unless and until China is on a similar economic and democratic level. If that takes 100 years, he has said, that's just fine. Mary Kay Magstead, NPR News, Beijing.
On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrials are up 2.5 points at 91.87. The Nasdaq is up 5 at 19.08. This is NPR. In NPR's business update, more earnings news plus a possible big bank deal are proving to be the major motivators for the stock market today. NPR's Jack Spear reports on how things are going for Wall Street today.
The big news broke well before most Wall Street traders had even rolled out of bed today. A report that Bank of New York was making an unsolicited play for Pittsburgh-based Mellon. The proposed more than $20 billion stock deal is being listed as among the largest unsolicited takeover bids ever. Mellon, for its part, says it's not for sale. Also moving the markets today, earnings news from Boeing and Xerox. Boeing says its earnings tumbled 91%. The company blames production bottlenecks at its plants. Xerox reports first quarter profits rose 12%. Microsoft, meanwhile, is scheduled to release its earnings later today. Jack Spear, NPR News, Washington.
Travelers who plan to fly Northwest Airlines could face a slowdown today. Northwest mechanics are staging the slowdown because they want the airline to settle contract talks that have dragged on since late 1996. The slowdown could result in flight delays and some cancellations across the country. Northwest says a small number of pilots and mechanics is involved, and the action has not been approved by the mechanics union. Home improvement chain retailer Lowe's is opening up new stores. The company says it expects to open 100 facilities throughout the West Coast and in the Rocky Mountain states over the next 3 to 4 years. The expansion will cost $1.5 billion. It's the first time that Lowe's will have opened stores further west than in Texas. Again on Wall Street, the Dow's up 2.5 points at 91.87. I'm Korva Coleman, National Public Radio News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from Borders Books and Music in more than 200 neighborhoods across the United States, where browsing is a fine art. 800-644-7733.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Barbara Bogave, sitting in for Terry Gross. This Sunday, Fox presents the 200th episode of The Simpsons, the longest-running primetime animated series in TV history. Matt Groening created the cartoon characters 11 years ago as short features for The Tracey Ullman Show and spun them off into their own series in 1990. Since then, there's been a TV animation renaissance that includes Beavis and Butthead, Ren and Stimpy, King of the Hill, and South Park. Fresh Air TV critic David Bianculli spoke with Matt Groening and asked him what this milestone means to him.
Working on a show like The Simpsons, there's no hiatus like on other TV shows. We're working year-round. It takes 6 months to do one episode, and we're obviously doing many, many episodes at the same time. So it's all a big cartoony blur to me these last, I don't even know, how many years has it been since the end of 1989?
Yeah.
And, you know, we look up from our drawing tables and, you know, and go, oh, 200? Oh, okay. I mean, we're way beyond 200 right now. I mean, working on episodes for next year. It's a good episode, by the way.
Uh-huh.
It's an excellent episode. It was written by Ian Maxtone Graham, directed by Jim Reardon, and it's Homer. Here's a pitch. Homer as the sanitation commissioner of Springfield. I know it doesn't sound that exciting, but it is.
Okay, I'll trust you.
It is.
The amazing thing about The Simpsons is that it's been going on for like 172 years now, and it is still consistently entertaining week in and week out, year in and year out, in a way that most TV series that last that long are not. You guys don't seem to slump.
I think one of the reasons why The Simpsons has sustained its velocity is that the each new group of animators and writers who comes on board tries to top the previous group, and we have a bunch of really talented people who are trying to cram as many jokes and observations as they can into every episode. And one thing I'm very proud of The Simpsons is that we don't have a laugh track, unlike every other sitcom on TV, although I don't think a laugh track would work anyway in animation. But anyway, we don't have one, so we get more jokes than usual in our shows. So I'm happy.
Now, with all of the new people coming in, that means old people are going out. It used to be in the late 70s and early 80s that MTM Productions was the place where people would go to learn TV and go out. And, of course, one of your partners, Jim Brooks, was one of the co-founders there.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm wondering if you can look back at the people that you have lost to other venues over the years for The Simpsons and point out who's doing what where now.
Well, let's see. Greg Daniels went from The Simpsons to King of the Hill and co-created that with Mike Judge. And the rest have disappeared into total obscurity. Oh, yeah, wait a minute. Conan O'Brien went on to some success.
Yeah, near total obscurity.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah, no, it's really fun to see Conan. And also, you know, on the internet, we get lots of fan comments, and we read them and are thoroughly annoyed by them. Thank you very much. But our fans are very critical. And one of the annoying posts is the idea that the show really hasn't been the same since Conan has been gone, and if we can only get Conan back. So we're trying to get Conan back. But
Hold your breath. What's the strangest thing that you've ever read from an internet posting? Either something that someone has caught as a joke that you never thought they would, or just some weird take on the show that you can't believe.
Well, the weirdest thing that ever happened on the as far as reading on the internet was my own obituary, which I read on April Fool's Day. Somebody posted that in the form of an Associated Press release that I had died of a heart attack in Jim Brooks's office, which is thoroughly possible, I suppose. But it didn't happen. And you know, it's always fascinating. You know that scene in Huckleberry Finn where Tom Sawyer and Huckleberry Finn are presumed dead and all that stuff. I always was fascinated by that idea of being able to read your own obituary. And it happened to me. And it was not as fun as I thought it was going to be.
Well, Huck got to attend his own funeral. You didn't go that far.
No, I didn't go that far.
Now, another thing about Jim Brooks is that, of course, he just got Helen Hunt and Jack Nicholson a couple of Oscars for As Good As It Gets. And it seems like the Jack Nicholson character in that is not that far off from your whole Life in Hell cartoon series.
Well, I don't know. I don't know about that. You know, one of the great things about Jim is his enthusiasm for acting and going for real emotions. I mean, back in the beginning of the show, one of the things that he made sure that we kept alive was the idea that you would forget you were watching a cartoon at certain points, that we'd go for moments of real emotion. And I think, actually, if there's any secret to the longevity of the Simpsons, it's to the extent that we've been able to follow that idea, which is to make the cartoons real. And, you know, we have great actors on the show who, despite the silly lines we give them and the grotesque way they're drawn, are able to bring these characters to life. We've tried using people who do cartoon voices from time to time on The Simpsons, and they're great at what they do, but the kind of emotional reality that we're going for is something that we haven't been able to capture except with the 7 or 8 people who provide regular voices on our cast. And there was actually some controversy about that too, because they were holding out for a lot more money, and you know, Fox considered hiring other actors to replace them, which of course would have been disastrous.
Well, I would think that just given your history, that you would side so readily with the vocal actor series cast regulars getting raises, that you would be not on the side of management but on the side of labor in that one.
Well, my attitude is that the Simpsons actors deserve to be as rich and unhappy as anyone in Hollywood. And so, you know,
that's
yeah,
a pretty
of course.
High
I mean,
bar.
You know, they look, the my whole reason for doing anything creatively is to have fun. And when this problem was first brought up and Fox was stubborn about not going for these hefty raises and all this stuff, I said, hey, look, if it's no fun, let's just not do it anymore. And they thought I was insane. As long as there's money to be made, I think the show will go on.
One thing I'm wondering about, since they do realize the value of the show at Fox, there has been no official Simpsons spinoff. And I know for a long time you wanted one and weren't sure in what direction you would take it. In terms of either television or film, where does that stand now? Or is there an entire new series that is coming from you fairly soon?
Well, part of the problem with The Simpsons is that there is so much money that that's going around and around in this project that anything that involves signing new contracts makes the actual negotiations difficult or impossible. I did try to do a Simpsons spinoff, Krusty the Clown. It was originally conceived as a live-action spinoff starring Dan Castellaneta, who does the voice of Krusty as well as Homer.
Uh-huh.
And I thought that would be an amusing conceit. That is, the idea that you would do a live-action spinoff of a cartoon. But I actually sat in a big room with a bunch of people, and we talked about this, and everybody took very, very greedy positions. And I said, hey, look, if you guys all take the second greediest position, we can do this thing. We can do it. It'll be fun. And you'll still make lots and lots of money. But let's do it. But they wouldn't take the second greediest position. Everybody wanted all the money, and you can't do it that way. So that's why there has never been a Simpsons spinoff, or why there's never been a Simpsons movie. I'd love to do it. I'd love to do a movie. But it ain't going to happen. There's too much money grubbing involved. That's why I had to go on and do my own TV show, my new one. I'm working on a new animated series where we're all going to work for free, and it's going to be fun. No, no, we're not. No, it's going to, you know, we're starting over, starting fresh, and, you know, it's going to be fun.
But you're starting fresh, and you're going to write the contract so that you retain rights this time?
You can't do it. It's Hollywood. It's crazy here. But what I do is I try to have more fun. I mean, that's the reason. This new show, which is very similar in sensibility to The Simpsons, it'll be fast-paced. The characters have big eyeballs, and they'll have no chins, and their skin's not going to be yellow. It's not a spinoff. It's a brand new show. Don't sue me. So anyway, it's where was I?
What the show is going to be? New show?
Oh yeah. So it's going to be it's going to take place in the future. It's kind of a science fiction thing. What we have done to the American family with The Simpsons, we're going to try to do to science fiction and the future with this new show. It's called Futurama. It'll be on Fox next year.
That's Matt Groening, creator of The Simpsons, speaking with Fresh Air TV critic David Bianculli. The 200th episode of The Simpsons will air this Sunday on the Fox network. We'll be back after a break. This is Fresh Air. Back to our interview with cartoonist Matt Groening. He's talking with TV critic David Bianculli.
Tell me more about how Jim Brooks and you hooked up in the first place. What was it that you think that he saw in you that made it a good pairing?
Well, Jim was working with a producer named Polly Platt, who liked my cartoon strip Life in Hell, which was running in the Los Angeles Reader at the time, a local weekly paper. And she showed him my stuff. He liked it. And they actually tried to get me to put my cartoons as background props in a movie that he was doing. And that didn't work out. And then the Tracy Ullman show came along, and they asked me if I wanted to try my hand at animation. And that was the beginning of it.
Where did you think it was going to lead? How long did you think that would last?
Well, they called me up, and they said were doing this new comedy variety show, and they wanted to have little animated cartoons as part of the show, and suggested that I animate my Life in Hell characters, which I thought was a great idea. I found out that I would give up ownership of whatever it is that I put up, and so I created The Simpsons in their stead, because, you know, Life in Hell with my rabbits and Akbar and Jeff, that's a regular gig, and I was doing just fine with that, and I didn't know if this animation thing was going to pan out at all. And I decided not to sacrifice my own characters, so I made up these other characters I didn't really care about. The Simpsons. And they were, you know, in the back of my mind, I really wanted to, you know, do this thing as a TV series. I thought it should be a TV series. And so it was inspired by both memories of my own family and in the family sitcoms that I was glued to when I was a kid. Leave It to Beaver and Ozzie and Harriet in particular were really important to me as a kid. You know, Ozzie and Harriet, everybody thinks, oh, Ozzie and Harriet. It's like this sort of symbol for blandness. And it was kind of corny and bland, but it was also really surreal. And I'm telling you, watch those reruns. They used to run them on the Disney Channel. I don't know where they are now, but they're fantastic, really. The good ones, the early ones. Not when Ricky and Dave got married, it wasn't as good. But when... when they were kids, when they were still going through adolescence, it was really a cool show.
One major element of The Simpsons that you're cashing in on lately with CD releases is...
Cashing in? Simpsons? Well, how can you even put those two words in the same sentence?
I don't know. But that was not a disparaging cashing in, because I listen to the CDs all the time.
Hey, cashing in Hollywood, that's the biggest superlative there is.
Well, how involved are you in the music with Danny Elfman, with everybody who does the music? I don't know how some of the episodes that are very heavy on music even get thought up in the first place. How do you know that everybody can do it when you're going to do a musical version of A Streetcar Named Desire, for example?
Well, I mean, we have talented actors who will throw themselves into this stuff. Alf Clausen, who does the music for the show, he was fantastic. He's able to come up with amazing solutions to the problems that are thrown at him. We're doing a second CD of stuff from the show, and I'm just amazed that we didn't run out of material from the first CD, but the show is jam-packed with music. You know, The Simpsons is one of the few shows that's actually fully orchestrated these days. I thought back at the very beginning of the show that we needed an orchestra because the animation was going to be so crude and wobbly that anything we could do to anchor the animation in some kind of solidity that you could at least hear would be a real help. And now I like it just because... I think I'm tired of synthesizers, which is what you hear on most other shows. I like that orchestral sound.
Mm-hmm. Tell me a little bit about Matt Groening at home when you're not at The Simpsons. How do you and your kids react to TV now? What life do you have when you're not working?
Well, I have two sons, aged 9 and 6, and they're huge fans of the show, and we have tapes of The Simpsons. And when I get up in the morning and come down to breakfast, they're usually watching the show. And I'm not in the best of mood before I've had my coffee, and so I tell them to shut it off. And they now think that I hate The Simpsons because I don't want to hear it before I, wake up in the morning. I don't like to be woken up to the sound of Bart. Also, another thing is, I'll take this opportunity to apologize to America. There was a lot of complaints about Bart and what a brat he was and a bad example for kids. And I thought, come on, grow up. Stop acting like Homer Simpson and your kids won't act like Bart Simpson. But the fact is, now that I have these kids and they're quoting the show back to me, it is really annoying. I mean, we did on The Simpsons. We did, are we there yet? Are we there yet? Are we there yet? In the car. My kids, still, years later, they still think that's funny.
What were some of the things that warped you early as a teenager? I know that Rocky and Bullwinkle had to be a big influence.
I loved Rocky and Bullwinkle. I've said this before. Jay Ward and Bill Scott, who did that, were my heroes, because here was bad animation. I mean, let's face it, the Rocky and Bullwinkle is pretty flimsy looking, but it had great writing, and it had great voices, and it had great music. And I thought, boy, if you could get something like that on the air again, it'd be really fun to do. And that was one of my goals in life. And
it's one of the animated rules that I remember you mentioning is that The Simpsons will never cross their eyes. And I don't know if that goes for the other characters in the show as well, but it's just one thing that you just didn't want to have your characters do.
Oh, yeah. Stylistically, there's a few rules on The Simpsons. That's one of them, that they don't go cross-eyed for gag effect. Like if you clonk them on the head, they don't go cross-eyed, and stars don't go above their heads, and little birds fly around or anything like that. Generally, when The Simpsons fall off the cliff, the unrealistic thing is that they survive, but the realistic thing is that they're, battered and bloody, So I think we're one of the first cartoons to actually show blood, I think even in the Tom and Jerry cartoons and some of the other very violent cat and mouse cartoons, there was no blood, but there's blood on The Simpsons.
And certainly on Itchy.
And I'm proud of that, yes. Too, because I don't know why.
Well, what are some of the other rules that you decided on at the very beginning when you were first?
Well, as far as eyeballs go, basically the characters look straight ahead or they go slightly wall-eyed to convey alienation. They don't go, they don't have that one eye up and one people up, one people down look, you know, for craziness too. What are some of the other rules? Just as far as sound effects, no boings, no boing, you know, when they get hit. All the sound effects are relatively realistic. I mean, you know, when Homer falls over and you know, cracks his back against a fire hydrant, I mean, it's a celery crunch, but it could be a spine.
Now,
it's that it's not a boing. You know, it's not a Three Stooges sound effect.
But with sound effects, is it true that you originally provided the sound effect that you did the sucking for Maggie on the pacifier?
Well, on the pacifier, yeah. Well, yes, I did.
And do they have you now turned that duty over to a pacifier specialist?
You know,
specialist?
I think through the miracle of modern technology, as far as I know, it's still the same suck. It's they only had to do it once, and then they just keep repeating it. You know, that's how it goes.
Wow,
that's just my tongue against my lower lip.
What do you have about keeping Bart, especially at that exact age in school?
You know, one of the great things about animation is that your actors don't get old and decrepit. You know, they don't rob stores. They don't they don't have tragic rehab stories. You know, anything like that. They just stay the way you draw them. And I think it's one of the fun things we have with The Simpsons is that Bart has turned 10 so many times. And you know, we've talked about aging them. When this actor's strike happened on the show, there was one suggestion from a Fox executive to, why don't you just age the characters and then have different voices? That's a solution. We thought that was not such a good
scary idea.
Matt Groening, creator of The Simpsons, talking with Fresh Air TV critic David Bianculli. We'll hear more from Matt Groening in the second half of our show. I'm Barbara Bogave, and this is Fresh Air.
Hello, gents. What will it be?
Poo! Give us a super squishy.
One that's made entirely out of syrup.
What's such a thing has never been done?
Just make it happen.
Oh dear.
Your turd, Bart.
Whoa, that's good squishy.
What's it like, Bart?
Oh, I don't remember anything.
Really? Not even this?
Ah! Oh, no! I must have joined the junior campers!
You, the proud, the geeky.
Boy, a man on a squishy bender can sure do some crazy things.
Okay, look, I made a terrible mistake. I wandered into a junior camper recruitment center, but what's done is done. I've made my bed, and now I've got to weasel out of it.
I know you think the junior campers are square and uncool, but they also do a lot of neat things, like sing-alongs and flag ceremonies.
Marge, don't discourage the boy. Weaseling out of things is important to learn. It's what separates us from the animals. Except the weasel.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Barnes & Noble, booksellers since 1873, and by the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, we continue our conversation with the creator of The Simpsons, Matt Groening. The series airs its 200th episode this Sunday. Also, how Boston reduced its crime rate among juveniles. We talk with Judge Sidney Hanlon and probation officer Bill Stewart. This is Fresh Air. I'm Barbara Bogave, in for Terry Gross. Let's go back now to our interview with cartoonist Matt Groening, creator of The Simpsons. He's speaking with TV critic David Bianculli. David asked him how The Simpsons are like other American families.
I think one of the things about The Simpsons is that it really is about the anxiety and consternation of living with people who drive you out of your mind. Because it's animation and because it's a comedy, we do a lot of foreshortening, a lot of slight exaggeration. I call it rubber band reality. That is, it's real, and then we stretch it out for a moment, and then it snaps back to reality. But it is about the things that drive you crazy. I mean, how do you live with people you love and you want to kill? I think that's the underlying theme of The Simpsons. And in the midst of all that, it's a celebration of that idea. That is, at the end of the day, it's not a Beckett play. It's a cartoon.
How do you think The Simpsons stacks up against more three-dimensional sitcoms? And in particular, the characters of the mothers, the fathers, and the kids?
Well, you know, I don't want to compare what we do to other TV shows in live action, because I think when I look at those shows, I go, God, how do they do that? How can you write scenes that take place in the same room, you know, week after week after week? You know, where characters just have to come in and out of doors in order to, you know, to move things around. I mean, in The Simpsons, we can go anywhere we want to. We can go into the characters' fantasy worlds. We can show the TV shows that they enjoy. We can go into outer space and underwater and all kinds of stuff. We have 40 or 50 characters in a single episode. And I think that it certainly spoiled me. When I tried to do that Krusty the Clown spinoff that I was talking about earlier, part of the problem of doing a live-action version of it is when I had written a scene in which this beaver was gnawing away at the foundation of Krusty's house. The fox said, "Do you realize how much it's going to cost to get a beaver? We can't get a trained beaver to gnaw on the wood. You know, a stuffed beaver was even going to cost a lot. And forget about a robotic beaver."
Besides,
so, if it's a cartoon, you can draw that beaver.
And Matt, to resort to the old beaver eating the house in the pilot.
Well, you know, it was the premise was that Krusty moved to Hollywood and became a big self-hating talk show host,
mm-hmm.
And he lived in a house on stilts. And he throughout the entire series, he was going to hear this gnawing sound and not quite figure out what it was. But we, the audience, would know that it was a beaver.
Well, tell me, in terms of since you watched so much TV as a kid, and I did as well.
You say that like an accusation.
No, I'm you know, actually...
Well, okay, here's the deal. You watch TV the way I did, and I really felt guilty about all the TV that I watched. I thought, geez, oh my God, it's the one life I have to live, and I'm just think of the commercials I've wasted, you know, watching all this life. Oh, God. And I thought, the only way I can make this pay off is I actually do a TV show. Then it's all research. Then I've justified it. So this is my pathetic attempt to make up for all that wasted time.
And so the reason for making a second one, now that you've justified the lifetime with the
first? Oh, the second one is really, and this is true, it's an attempt to do the first one right. It's an attempt to have fun this time. Not that The Simpsons hasn't been fun, but it's been a mix. And I've learned a lot over the course of these last 11 years since I've been working with these characters. And this time, I know what to expect. I know how to do it, and I'm going to have a lot more fun.
Do you have any sense watching your kids right now that they're getting the same seditious enjoyment out of mass media or even alternative media that you did when you were a kid?
Well, I tried to. This is going to sound worse than it is, but I tried to use my kids as a little experiment. What I tried to do is see what happens if you don't hold back on what the kids are able to look at. I mean, I don't let them watch really scary horror movies or things like that, but they get to watch videos, they get to play video games, they have their computer and their CD-ROMs and their musical instruments and comic books and magazines and monster books and all the rest of that stuff. And I just pretty much don't put a limit on the kinds of stuff they can look at or view or play with. And as a result, or not as a result, but in my particular experiment, I got kids who read like crazy and play video games like crazy too and watch tapes of The Simpsons. So far it's worked out really well because they're interested in everything. And, you know, I had to sneak around a little bit. And maybe the reason why it was so fun for me was because a lot of the stuff was a little bit taboo. And with them, they take it for granted. I say, when I was a kid, we didn't have CD-ROMs. There's a lot of good stuff from the olden days that I force on my kids. I turned them on to Little Lulu comics from the 1950s, for instance. I mean, really good comics.
And that stuff scared me.
Little Lulu?
Yes. I don't know why. What's your problem? Well, that's for another show. Listen, I want to thank you for being on this
one. No, I'm not letting you go.
Yeah.
Okay. Okay, go ahead.
No, it's okay.
Sorry.
No, I just have to say we actually are out of time, and I wanted to say thanks for being here.
Thanks. Say hi to Terry.
I sure will.
Matt Groening, creator of The Simpsons, spoke with Fresh Air TV critic David Bianculli. The Simpsons airs its 200th episode this Sunday. Coming up, fighting teenage violence on the streets of Boston. This is Fresh Air. There's a series running now on PBS called In Search of Law and Order, which examines different approaches to combating juvenile crime. One city highlighted in the series is Boston, which in 1990 saw a record-setting 152 murders due to gang drug turf wars. In response, community members and law enforcement in Boston started a new collaborative approach to fighting juvenile crime. They brought in the Federal Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, and Firearms. They set up a mentoring program called the Streetworkers, and they got out the word that they wouldn't hesitate to slam repeat offenders with long federal prison terms. Since then, the murder rate in Boston among teenagers has dropped 65%, and Boston has been held up as a model for other cities fighting youth violence. My guests are Probation Officer Bill Stort and Judge Sidney Hanlon, presiding justice in Dorchester District Court in Boston. We'll hear from Judge Hanlon a little later in the interview. In the mid-80s, Stort says some neighborhoods were like war zones. There were shootings near the courthouse in Dorchester. I asked Stort just how brazen the gangs were and if they actually came into the courthouse itself.
Well, first of all, you had to know that they were a gang, and they made no bones about who they were. They would march into the courthouse 10, 15, 20 deep to back, quote-unquote, one of their friends who had been arrested. They try to take over the courthouse. They would try to intimidate people. They would intimidate witnesses out in the hallway. I remember a case back in 1986. There were a rash of full-length goose down jackets being robbed at the public transportation stations. And when one of the individuals was brought in for trial, he brought in 20 of his friends. And I was sitting in the courtroom watching it, and the victim would not go forward with the case. And I talked to him outside after the case was dismissed for want of prosecution, lack of prosecution. And, you know, I said, you know, we'll help you, we'll cover you, we'll protect you. But that was wrong. We couldn't have done it. It could not have been done. It was a stupid thing to say. So they tried to stake themselves out in the courthouse. They had already staked themselves out in the neighborhood. And they were beginning to root.
One of the programs you helped create in Boston in response to this gang activity is called Operation Nightlight. You had you yourself and your other probation officers go out on house visits with the police to check up on kids violating probation. What was the thinking behind the pairing up? What was it supposed to accomplish?
Well, probation officers have always been out on the street or in the schools, but we've got away from working at night. When I started in the business 21 years ago, I made it a habit of driving around at night just to check on kids and parks and places that they would hang around. We got away from that. We became, our role became that of service brokers. We, an individual, an offender, would come into the courthouse, and during the course of the interview, we would try to identify problems. And in that term, we would tie them up with resources to get to the bottom line, which is to get them to deviate from criminal behavior. It wasn't an easy bond to make because bureaucracy being what it is, we felt in the courthouse, we have our problems, the police have their problems. We'll solve ours, police will solve theirs. Probation will go home at 4:30, and we expected the police to enforce our terms of probation. Nobody had ever told us, Barbara, that we weren't trained this way, but nobody had ever told us about some of the powers that probation officers do have. It wasn't in our training. It's nobody's fault that that happened, but we had gotten away from the fact that we can make arrests. We can do things when we have reasonable suspicion as opposed to probable cause that somebody's in violation of their terms of probation. We can make an arrest, but we weren't trained that way. So obviously we needed the police department and a partnership with the police department to put that in motion.
What changed once you started going out with the police and confronting these kids in their houses, in their bedrooms, or on the street corner?
Well, what happened, you know, one of my favorite stories, obviously, was the first night of the joint operation after we put the plan in motion. 1 minute into the first ride on November 12, 1992, there was a radio call and a shooting on Nelson Street. When we got to the scene, myself and my partner, Richie Skinner, along with our police partners, Bobby Myrner and Bobby Fratalia, the co-creators of the program, there was a young guy in the middle of the street, Tito Blanco by name, who had a 30-30 hole in his chest. He was still alive. Richie had him on probation. In fact, Tito had been in that day to see him. I walked around the police tape that had been set up and saw across the tape six young men that we knew, I knew, and who by terms of probation were not supposed to be there, nor were they supposed to be out in the street that late at night. They were all supposed to be in the house at 8 o'clock. So I walked around the police tape and on purpose walked into a young man by the name of James. And he turned around, he looked at me, and the first comment out of his mouth is, "What are you doing here?" And I said, "Well, I'm out riding in the 5-0, which is a street slang for police car." And his comment back to me was, "That's not fair. You're not supposed to do that." And I think the program was built on that statement. If they didn't think it was fair, then that's what we had to do.
So before this, kids out violating their curfews just wouldn't get caught. They could really get away with pretty much whatever they wanted to, as long as it wasn't, you know, overtly illegal.
Well, on terms, by virtue of the terms of probation, what happened back in 1990 is we changed the terms of probation in the Dorchester court because of there was one cataclysmic event, that being the Kimberly Ray Harbor murder on Halloween night in 1990, when eight juveniles dragged a young lady off a street, and they beat her and raped her and stabbed her 132 times. What we did is we took the standard terms of probation that we use in the state of Massachusetts, which were four, and added eight terms. Once the police department in 1990, Boston Police Department, admitted that we had a gang problem and designated a gang as a group of three or more individuals involved in criminal activity, we wrote that into the terms of probation. You can't be out after 8 or 9 o'clock, you can't hang on the corner of Walk and Don't Walk Street, and you can't be in a group larger than three.
Since you've started the program, how have you assessed how well it's working?
It's been tremendous, Barbara. I think, you know, one of the greatest aspects of the program and one of the ongoing benefits that we see, all of us who go out, we started small, and now in Boston on any given night or during in a 7-day week, which started with two police officers and two probation officers, is now 50 police officers, 50 probation officers, seven nights a week checking on curfews and checking on offenders. Never has there been a situation where a door has been kicked in, where we've exerted pressure on the individual in their home. That's not what the program is about, and we didn't want that. We can always work with somebody. We can bring an individual into court the next day, into the office, and work with them there. There's no need to enforce terms in their bedroom in most situations. But the ongoing benefit to the program is the response from the parents. We'll knock on a door, and we'll ask to see an offender, and more often than not, we get from the parent, "Thank God you're here. God bless you for doing this. This is wonderful. It's just what he needs." And so the response, that's what pretty much what the program has been built on, that response from the parents.
A lot of these kids are under curfew. What are they supposed to do at home all evening?
We've had no trouble. In fact, the compliance rate with terms of probation went from 30 to 70% once we went out and started knocking on doors at night. It's easy to drive a kid off the street, but now the question is, where have we driven them? In more cases, and you know, in some of the stories, some of the things that I've seen, we caught a kid out one night, and I asked him, I said, "You know, you're out after curfew. I do have the power of arrest for violation of probation." And his body slumped. I said, "What's the problem?" And he didn't want to talk in front of the officers, so I took him aside and got out of him the information that his mother's boyfriend comes over the house. And when he's over, he beats him up. He didn't want to be in the house. So I asked him if he was hungry, and he indicated that he was. So I said, "Why don't you hop in the car? We'll go down and do a Big Mac attack or something like that." And I said, "But I'll ask your mother for permission." So I went back in the house and talked to the mother, got the mother out, and got the boyfriend out. And had a real one-way conversation with the mother about the fact that it was her son. She was putting him in a bad position, and that's her blood. Boyfriends come and go, but her son is her son forever, basically was the tone of the conversation. And I really wouldn't look favorably if, when we came back, if the boyfriend was in the house. So when we did, in fact, return after doing the Mickey D run, he was gone. That's a good thing.
My guest is Bill Stort, probation officer in Dorchester District Court in Boston. We'll talk more after the break. This is Fresh Air. Back with probation officer Bill Stort of Dorchester District Court in Boston. We'll be joined by Judge Sidney Hanlon later in our conversation. Operation Nightlight was just one in a series of programs that you've initiated at the Boston criminal justice system aimed at lessening gang violence. Another one's called Operation Ceasefire. I'd like you to tell us how the police and court officials and state and city and federal forces all work together to get the message out that gang violence just wouldn't be tolerated.
Well, what happened, because of the success of the partnership between police and probation and Nightlight, the next logical step was to see if we could get more partners to the table. There was an incident where a young man came into my partner's office, Richie Skinner's office, and gave him information on a gun ring. The Boston police took that and had a gun sting operation where there was an individual taken down who was running guns from down south. The Boston police next took the step to build a relationship with the ATF agency, Alcohol, Tobacco, and Firearms. So now we had three partners sitting at the table, and the program ballooned from there. Now at any given time, we've got 17 agencies sitting at a table who are all working together. If you're bad enough, the Suffolk County District Attorney can send you to state's prison for 15 years. If you're real good, if you're a real good offender, if you've got a huge record and you fit the profile, then you're going to meet my friend, the United States Attorney General, at the end of the table. We have a poster child, and I hate to use that word, but in fact, we go out and publicize that there was a young man by the name of Freddie Cardoza who was caught with a bullet. He was also caught passing a gun to a juvenile because the juvenile would get a lesser sentence. Freddie received 5 years for handing the gun to the juvenile and 14 years and 9 months for possession of a single bullet. But Freddie also had a six-page record. So we sent the message out, individuals like that are not going to be tolerated in the neighborhood or the city.
I read somewhere that you as a kid had a run-in with a kind of gang, or went by the name of a gang. A kid tried or did stab you.
Yeah, I did. Yeah, I'm lucky. I was 12. I was with my father then December 28th, 1962 he was refereeing a college hockey game in RPI in Troy, New York, and one of my favorite college players gave me a stick. And I took the stick the next day, went out and skated on a pond, and a group of four or five kids came up to me late in the day. They wanted the stick, and I wouldn't give it to them. I never saw the knife coming. 3 weeks later, I get home, some 156 stitches. So that was my first involvement with a gang. I'm lucky. I've been told that I was coated on the table and brought back. So I'm playing with the bank's money.
My guests are Probation Officer Bill Stewart and Judge Sydney Hanlon. She's the presiding justice in Dorchester District Court in Boston. Boston has been held up as a national model in the past decade for innovative programs to combat youth crime. Judge Hanlon, I'd like to talk to you about how some of the new initiatives, and I'm thinking of Project Nightlight and the Street Workers Mentoring Program and Operation Ceasefire, how all of that has, or whether all of that has given you more discretion in setting terms for probation and in sentencing.
Absolutely. If you have some sense that the terms of your probation or the terms of your sentence are going to be enforced, then you can impose more terms. That is, it's kind of useless and counterproductive to say to somebody, I want you to finish school. That's a nice wish. But unless you're sure that somebody is going to be out there monitoring that, somebody's going to see whether that young person is actually in school every day, telling him he's got to go to school without the enforcement does more harm than good, because it gives him a sense that it's just words and he's pulled one over on the system when he doesn't show up the second day after you've put him on probation.
Do you see a different attitude among the kids who come before you in court since Boston started these initiatives? A different respect, or any respect for authority, or maybe a higher awareness of the consequences of their actions?
I think that most of the kids do have a lot of respect for authority. I hear sometimes, oh, he doesn't care about being committed to the Department of Youth Services, which is the correctional facility for juveniles. He doesn't mind. He can do time standing on his head. I never saw anybody give me that attitude in the courtroom. Some of the toughest kids walk out in tears. I think they, for the most part, they do have respect for authority. The difference is I think they have a sense now that we'll work together. So that I can say, you know, I expect you to go to school every day, and if you think I won't send you for not going to school, you ask around. And for the most part, I have the sense that they have, and they've talked to other people, or they've seen me before and they know. I've seen young adults who know me from when they were juveniles, and they say to the lawyer, no, 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 I'll take what she's offering because I know she'll send me.
There's a lot of scrutiny now of juvenile prisons and imprisonment, how to treat young offenders once you send them to jail, and whether violent youths should be tried as adults and serve time with adults. Have juvenile detention facilities in Boston also changed in any way along with the changes that you've made in probation and gun control and sentencing?
Massachusetts has been a national model for a lot of years in terms of treatment for violent offenders. The problem has been, and I think this is in the process of being remedied and has changed, it's been the amount of money that's been spent on it. They have the programs. They work with young people in small groups, not more than 15 or 20, so that the youth culture doesn't take over. You don't have more kids than responsible adults, so they don't set the terms, and you don't have violence in the institution. It's education intensive. It's behavior modification therapy with a really structured sense of points and what behavior is acceptable and what's not, and how to earn rewards like a radio or a visit or a time at home. It's a really, really good program. The problem in the early 90s, when there was so much violence, is there weren't enough slots. And so if you could get a kid into the slot, he'd probably get pretty good attention. But because there were a few slots, kids were getting into them later and later, and the older and the more violent somebody's been involved in, the harder it is to change. We do have now an automatic transfer to the adult system for murders. It was pretty controversial. I think they didn't give the earlier reforms a chance to work, but that's the system. That's what we've decided, and I think we've pretty much tried to let it go now and put the efforts into the kids who have not convicted actually of murder.
Judge Sidney Hanlon and Bill Stewart, I want to thank you very much for talking with me today on Fresh Air.
Thanks, Barbara.
Thanks very much for giving us a chance to talk with you.
Probation Officer Bill Stewart and Presiding Justice Sidney Hanlon of Dorchester District Court in Boston. Boston is featured in the new PBS series In Search of Law and Order, Reclaiming America's Kids. Part 3 on Richmond, California airs this Friday nationwide. Fresh Air's interviews and reviews are produced by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, and Naomi Person, with Monique Nazareth, Tracy Tannenbaum, and Alan Tu. Today is the anniversary of the birth of jazz musician and composer Charles Mingus. We'll close with Mingus playing his own composition, Hog Callin' Blues. For Terry Gross, I'm Barbara Bogave.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, in the wake of Pol Pot's death, we look at the continuing effort to bring Khmer Rouge war criminals to justice. We'll talk with Ben Kiernan, director of the Cambodian Genocide Program. I'm Barbara Bogave. I hope you'll join us for the next Fresh Air.